Hi, my name is Bob Sander, and I'm a professional storyteller. For over 30 years, my repertoire has included a group of personal narrative stories. Some of these are childhood memories, stories lived when, well, basically when I was a knucklehead in training, so to speak. Other stories come from my college student era, and still others date from my time as a beginner parent. And you know, by then I was kind of a professional knucklehead. While I do tell personal tales that are, well, either too risque or too this or too that to include here, you know, if you come to dinner some night, we'll eat and drink and I'll spill the beans on all those stories. But this collection, this bunch makes the cut. So I hope you enjoy them. And as for truthfulness, well, just know that these stories are absolutely 100% as true as I can make them. Enjoy. Mr. Clark was 92 years old and living in a retirement center, and when he told me that nothing had ever happened in his whole life, so he had no stories to tell, I was pretty shocked. Also incredulous and kind of saddened all at the same time. The stunned silence formed by his remark was like a big white blank canvas onto which any image could be painted. And, of course, that was exactly what Mr. Clark was after. Little did we know. Into that silence, Mr. Clark just kind of murmured, "Well, I did know Edison." I said, "The inventor? That Edison? Thomas Alva Edison?" "Yeah. I knew Frank Capra, too."
"Frank Capra?"
"Yeah. Film director. I sold him Cadillacs. 5 of them. Not all at once, though."
"Are you kidding?"
"Nope." Long pause followed. Mr. Clark gazed at his dumbfounded and entirely hooked audience, and he said, "Folks, if you were on a public conveyance, traveling from one place to another, and a vague feeling came over you that you should bring that conveyance to a sudden stop, and the power to do so presented itself, would you go ahead and do it?" Now, I ask you, have you ever heard a better or even a weirder lead-in to a story? For 3 months, I'd come to this retirement facility to meet the residents. They were all interested in hearing and telling stories. I'd show up, tell a story or two to kind of grease the wheels, and let this little small group of elders take over. Well, it didn't take much prompting. They began to tell and hear and learn things about one another that, well, things that just never came up any other way, any other time. It was a marvelous, close sharing, and soon we all looked forward to the small, quiet story circle on the second and fourth Sundays. It seemed odd to me that only women came, but never any men, so I asked about it one day. "We don't know," said one of the women. "We've asked the men to come. Maybe they're afraid." "Well, afraid of what?" "Talking in front of other people, we don't know for sure." "Well, do your darndest to get some men to come, will you? Next time, bring a man along." On the next meet date, the usual women filed in, and they were followed by a man. He was in a wheelchair being pushed by a staff worker. He was very small and frail-looking, kind of withered and not much left to fill out his clothes, you know. He wore a brimless little cap, and he had sky blue eyes that were sunken back into his kind of gaunt face, sort of a hawk nose. He was introduced as Mr. Clark, a fellow resident. None of the women remembered inviting him. When his turn came, we struggled to understand him. He had a slight speech defect that made his words a little hard to follow until you got accustomed to hearing the way he talked. When he reasoned that we had had time to unravel his comment, 92 years and nothing worth remembering, he kind of lowered the boom on us, as you now know. And then he said, "In 1933 or 1934, I traveled from Indianapolis to Louisville and back again by train. It was a business trip. I wasn't going to be gone but 2 days. While we were speeding down the rails, I was sitting in my seat, looking out the window. As we passed a big stretch of water, a lake, I think, I noticed something unusual. There's little burps of water rising up from the lake, just shooting up like little tiny geysers. Right then, a strange feeling came over me, and I felt like I had to stop that speeding train, and I mean immediately. That's when I looked up, and I saw that long cord that runs near the ceiling inside the train compartment. It was the emergency brake. I stood right up and stared at it. Mr. Clark pinned us with another silence in his water-blue eyes, and then he said, "Would you have reached out your hand and pulled that cord with nothing more than some little water spouts and a feeling?" We all said, "Well, probably not." But what happened next? Well, next, I reached my hand up toward that cord. I was determined to pull it. That's when the conductor walked over and grabbed my wrist, and he said, "What in the world do you think you're doing?" And I said to him, "I'm fixing to pull this emergency cord and bring this train to a halt right now." Well, he responded by saying, "You will do no such a thing." And we started in scuffling, and I don't know if it was him or me that got tangled in that cord, but one of us surely did pull it. Well, bags flew through the air. People fell onto the floor. Oh, it was a grand commotion entirely. The conductor's face turned an amazing shade of red. He told me to get in my seat, not move an inch. Then he got off and walked up to the engine to tell the engineer what had happened. Now, there was more silence after that. And then Mr. Clark looked at us with those blue eyes of his, and he said, "Now, would you have stayed in your seat, or would you have gotten off to look around, too?" We said we would stay put, we assured him, but we guessed that he did not. "Exactly right," said Mr. Clark, and now he was using his speech impediment with obvious purpose and skill. I followed that conductor clear up to the front of the train, and that's when I saw it. There was a 20-foot-long hewn timber beam, not a tree, and it was jammed up under the front of the train. One end of that beam was digging down into the gravel railroad bed, spewing rocks up into the air. Likely some of them were cast out into the lake we passed, and that's what made those little jets of water I'd seen. The engineer, he said, if we'd gone much further, that timber would probably have derailed the train. We all might have been killed. Everybody wondered where such a thing could have come from. The engineer said there's only one way to know, and that's back the train up and have a look around. So that's what we did. 5 miles outside a small town that we had passed, here we were coming back, and there was a crowd gathered around the railroad crossing. And there was a flatbed lumber truck, smashed to pieces. The man who drove it was alive, but totally insensible, sitting on the ground, and there was his wife next to him. She'd been riding with him, and she was laid out on the ground, stone dead. The townspeople were saying to the engineer, We told him not to do it. He's all the time trying to race and beat the train through that crossing. We told him not to do it many, many times, but he never listened. They said the accident was tragic, but no one was surprised. Things wound up as best as could be, and we continued on, and I saw to my business in Louisville. And now the next day, on the trip back home, who should I see on the train with me? It was the engineer from the day before, on that trip we made down to Louisville, and he's sitting in the seat just in front of me. He wasn't working. He's just riding back as a passenger this time. Somebody else is up doing the engineer business. So I asked him, "Why did you not stop when you hit that truck?" And he said, "Well, we didn't know we'd hit it."
"You didn't know? How could you not know?"
"Oh, well, shoot. I was in the back with the other firemen having lunch at the time."
Having lunch? You mean no one was running the train? He said to me,
Well, look, buddy, it's not like driving a car. You don't steer it. It's on tracks, right? Only got one way to go. Once we got through the town, we cranked her up and let her rip. There wasn't going to be another major crossing for 40 miles. We were running flat out when that fella tried to make the crossing. Now, at that speed, you don't feel a thing. A little jiggle, maybe. Train lurches around all the time anyway. We didn't notice anything unusual.
Really? Well, you must have been going awfully fast to not even feel an impact like that. How fast is a train going when it's going flat out?
I can't tell you that. That's official railroad business. You best get on back to your seat. Well, the by now expected Mr. Clark silent stare followed. After a little while, he asked us, "Now, if he told you that, would you just give up on finding out how fast the train was going, or not?"
"Likely we would give up," we said, "but surely you did not."
"That's correct," said Mr. Clark. "I had a friend in Indianapolis who worked for the railroad. He told me I could ride with him up in the engine to Illinois and back on a run they were going to make. But first, he made me sign a piece of paper that said if I didn't do exactly what he instructed, he could stop the train anywhere and put me off."
Mr. Clark kind of grinned, and then he said,
"Somewhere, I don't know where, he got the notion I had trouble following orders." So a few days later, traveling along in the engine of another train with his friend, the friend showed him that they were hitting 70 miles an hour running flat out. "See that gauge?" Mr. Clark's friend asked him. "That is a pressure gauge. When the needle gets into the red area, we either pull this cord for the whistle to sound, or we yank on this lever here, and that sends some heat back to the passengers. Either way, it relieves some pressure, and that is what you want. You don't want an explosion in the boiler from the pressure buildup. Do you understand?"
"Oh, yeah, I get it," Mr. Clark said to him.
"Hey, where are you going?"
"Well, I'm going back to have lunch with the brakeman. Now, you just keep your eye on that gauge, and if it goes into the red, you know what to do."
"What? Wait, you're leaving me here alone?"
"Ah, sure. There's nothing between here and Urbana. I'll be back in 10 minutes. I just want to eat. You might as well earn your keep."
And then he was gone. Mr. Clark told us he kept looking at that gauge and pulling that cord to sound the whistle and sending heat back to the passengers.
"After a while," said Mr. Clark, "I started to relax and enjoy it a bit. But that all changed when I looked out the window. In the distance, a light was coming towards us. There was another train on the track. We were going to hit, head on. I couldn't leave the compartment," Mr. Clark said to us. "I couldn't go fetch the engineer. We'd build up too much pressure. Maybe it'd blow up. I was screaming his name as loud as I could, but the noise in the engine room was fearsome. No one could hear me. Finally, I laid on the whistle, and I just didn't stop, hoping someone would come forward. And you know what? No one did." And then Mr. Clark pinned us with that look of his. But we all said, "For God's sakes, Mr. Clark, will you just tell us what happened next?"
"Well," he said, and buddy, he was clearly enjoying our discomfort. "What happened next was, I took a last glance out the window so as to look my doom square in the face. That little light was looming quite large now, as that onrushing train was nearly on us. They were blowing their whistle, too. It was all up. There was no stopping now. Too fast, too close. The last second, I don't know why I did it, but I ducked my head inside. Again, I don't know why I did that. It was not going to make any difference. Whoop! Went the wind from the other train as it passed us by, no more than 6 feet away. It was on another track, invisible to me in the darkness. And then Mr. Clark, the man with no stories to tell, he made a suitable pause, and he ended with these words. "You know, if the passengers on that train had known who was up in the engine compartment that night, I believe they all would have pulled that emergency brake, and I would not blame them." And that's the end of the story about Mr. Clark.